This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Gemma Blythe. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Chapter 6, Part 16. Scarcely, indeed, had the encampment been formed when there were rumors of quarrels between the Protestant and Popish soldiers. A little tract, entitled A Humble and Hearty Address to All English Protestants in the Army, had been actively circulated through the ranks. The writer vehemently exhorted the troops to use their arms in defense, not of the mass book, but of the Bible, of the Great Charter, and of the Petition of Right. He was a man already under the frown of power. His character was remarkable, and his history not uninstructive. His name was Samuel Johnson. He was a priest of the Church of England, and had been chaplain to Lord Russell. Johnson was one of those persons who are mortally hated by their opponents and less loved than respected by their allies. His morals were pure, his religious feelings ardent, his learning and abilities not contemptible, his judgment weak, his temper acrimonious, turbulent, and unconquerably stubborn. His profession made him peculiarly odious to the zealous supporters of monarchy. For a republic in holy orders was a strange and almost an unnatural being. During the late reign, Johnson had published a book entitled Julian the Apostate. The object of this work was to show that the Christians of the 4th century did not hold the doctrine of non-resistance. It was easy to produce passages from Chrysostom and Jerome, written in a spirit very different from that of the Anglican divines who preached against the Exclusion Bill. Johnson, however, went further. He attempted to revive the odious imputation which had, for very obvious reasons, been thrown by Labienus on the Christian soldiers of Julian, and insinuated that the dart which slew the imperial renegade came not from the enemy, but from some Rumbold, or Ferguson in the Roman ranks. A hot controversy followed. Whig and Tory disputants wrangled fiercely about an obscure passage in which Gregory of Nazianzus praises a pious bishop who is going to bastinado somebody. The Whigs maintained that the holy man was going to bastinado the emperor. The Tories that, at the worst, he was only going to bastinado a captain of the guard. Johnson prepared a reply to his assailants, in which he drew an elaborate parallel between Julian and James, then Duke of York. Julian had, during many years, pretended to abhor idolatry, while in heart an idolater. Julian had, to serve a turn, occasionally affected respect for the rights of conscience. Julian had punished cities which were zealous for the true religion by taking away their municipal privileges. Julian had, by his flatterers, been called the Just. James was provoked beyond endurance. Johnson was prosecuted for a libel, convicted and condemned to a fine which he had no means of paying. He was therefore kept in jail, and it seemed likely that his confinement would end only with his life. Over the room which he occupied in the King's Bench prison lodged another offender, whose character well deserves to be studied. This was Hugh Speke, a young man of good family and of a singularly base and depraved nature. His love of mischief and of dark and crooked ways amounted almost to madness. To cause confusion without being found out was his business and his pastime, and he had a rare skill in using honest enthusiasts as the instruments of his cold-blooded malice. He had attempted, by means of one of his puppets, to fasten on Charles and James the crime of murdering Essex in the Tower. On this occasion, the agency of Speke had been traced, and though he succeeded in throwing the greater part of the blame on his dupe, he had not escaped with impunity. He was now a prisoner, but his fortune enabled him to live with comfort, and he was under so little restraint that he was able to keep up regular communication with one of his confederates who managed a secret press. Johnson was the very man for Speke's purposes, zealous and intrepid, a scholar and a practiced controversialist, yet as simple as a child. A close intimacy sprang up between the two fellow prisoners. Johnson wrote a succession of bitter and vehement treatises, which Speke conveyed to the printer. When the camp was formed at Hounslow, Speke urged Johnson to compose an address which might excite the troops to mutiny. The paper was instantly drawn up. Many thousands of copies were struck off and brought to Speke's room, whence they were distributed over the whole country, and especially among the soldiers. A milder government than that which then ruled England would have been moved to high resentment by such a provocation. Strict search was made. A subordinate agent who had been employed to circulate the address saved himself by giving up Johnson, and Johnson was not the man to save himself by giving up Speke. An information was filed, and a conviction obtained without difficulty. Julian Johnson, as he was popularly called, was sentenced to stand thrice on the pillory and to be whipped from Newgate to Tyburn. The judge, Sir Francis Withens, told the criminal to be thankful for the great lenity of the Attorney General, who might have treated the case as one of high treason. "I owe him no thanks," answered Johnson dauntlessly. "Am I, whose only crime is that I have defended the church and the laws, to be grateful for being scourged like a dog, while popish scribblers are suffered daily to insult the church and to violate the laws with impunity?" The energy with which he spoke was such that both the judges and the crown lawyers thought it necessary to vindicate themselves, and protested that they knew of no popish publications such as those to which the prisoner alluded. He instantly drew from his pocket some Roman Catholic books and trinkets, which were then freely exposed for sale under the royal patronage, read aloud the titles of the books, and threw a rosary across the table to the king's council. "And now," he cried with a loud voice, "I lay this information before God, before this court, and before the English people. We shall soon see whether Mr. Attorney will do his duty." It was resolved that, before the punishment was inflicted, Johnson should be degraded from the priesthood. The prelates who had been charged by the Ecclesiastical Commission with the care of the Diocese of London cited him before them in the chapter house of St. Paul's Cathedral. The manner in which he went through the ceremony made a deep impression on many minds. When he was stripped of his sacred robe, he exclaimed, "You are taking away my gown, because I have tried to keep your gowns on your backs." The only part of the formalities which seemed to distress him was the plucking of the Bible out of his hand. He made a faint struggle to retain the sacred book, kissed it, and burst into tears. "You cannot," he said, "deprive me of the hopes which I owe to it." Some attempts were made to obtain a remission of the flogging. A Roman Catholic priest offered to intercede in consideration of a bribe of £200. The money was raised, and the priest did his best, but in vain. "Mr. Johnson," said the king, "has the spirit of a martyr, and it is fit that he should be one." William III said, a few years later, of one of the most acrimonious and intrepid Jacobites, "He has set his heart on being a martyr, and I have set mine on disappointing him." These two speeches would alone suffice to explain the widely different fates of the two princes. The day appointed for the flogging came. A whip of 9 lashes was used. 317 stripes were inflicted, but the sufferer never winced. He afterwards said that the pain was cruel, but that, as he was dragged at the tail of the cart, he remembered how patiently the cross had been borne up Mount Calvary, and was so much supported by the thought that, but for the fear of incurring the suspicion of vainglory, he would have sung a psalm with as firm and cheerful a voice as if he had been worshipping God in the congregation. It is impossible not to wish that so much heroism had been less alloyed by intemperance and intolerance. Among the clergy of the Church of England, Johnson found no sympathy. He had attempted to justify rebellion. He had even hinted approbation of regicide. And they still, in spite of much provocation, clung to the doctrine of non-resistance. But they saw with alarm and concern the progress of what they considered as a noxious superstition, and while they abjured all thought of defending their religion by the sword, betook themselves manfully to weapons of a different kind. To preach against the errors of popery was now regarded by them as a point of duty and a point of honor. The London clergy, who were then in abilities and influence decidedly at the head of their profession, set an example which was bravely followed by their ruder brethren all over the country. Had only a few bold men taken this freedom, they would probably have been at once cited before the Ecclesiastical Commission. But it was hardly possible to punish an offence which was committed every Sunday by thousands of divines from Berwick to Penzance. The presses of the capital, of Oxford, and of Cambridge never rested. The act which subjected literature to a censorship did not seriously impede the exertions of Protestant controversialists, for it contained a proviso in favor of the two universities and authorized the publication of theological works licensed by the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was therefore out of the power of the government to silence the defenders of the established religion. They were a numerous, an intrepid, and a well-appointed band of combatants. Among them were eloquent declaimers, expert dialecticians, scholars deeply read in the writings of the fathers and in all parts of ecclesiastical history. Some of them, at a later period, turned against one another the formidable arms which they had wielded against the common enemy, and by their fierce contentions and insolent triumphs brought reproach on the church which they had saved. But at present they formed a united phalanx. In the van appeared a rank of steady and skillful veterans. Tillotson, Stillingfleet, Sherlock, Prideaux, Whitby, Patrick, Tennyson, Wake. The rear was brought up by the most distinguished bachelors of arts who were studying for deacon's orders. Conspicuous amongst the recruits whom Cambridge sent to the field was a distinguished pupil of the great Newton, Henry Wharton, who had a few months before been senior wrangler of his year, and his early death was soon after deplored by men of all parties as an irreparable loss to letters. Oxford was not less proud of a youth whose great powers, first essayed in this conflict, afterwards troubled the church and the state during 40 eventful years, Francis Atterbury. By such men as these, every question and issue between the Papists and the Protestants was debated, sometimes in a popular style which boys and women could comprehend, sometimes with the utmost subtlety of logic, and sometimes with an immense display of learning. The pretensions of the Holy See, the authority of tradition, purgatory, transubstantiation, the sacrifice of the Mass, the adoration of the host, the denial of the cup to the laity, confession, penance, indulgences, extreme unction, the invocation of saints, the adoration of images, the celibacy of the clergy, the monastic vows, the practice of celebrating public worship in a tongue unknown to the multitude, the corruptions of the court of Rome, the history of the Reformation, the characters of the chief reformers, were copiously discussed. Great numbers of absurd legends about miracles wrought by saints and relics were translated from the Italian and published as specimens of the priestcraft by which the greater part of Christendom had been fooled. Of the tracts put forth on these subjects by Anglican divines during the short reign of James II, many have probably perished. Those which may still be found in our great libraries make up a mass of near 20,000 pages. The Roman Catholics did not yield the victory without a struggle. One of them, named Henry Hills, had been appointed printer to the royal household and chapel, and had been placed by the king at the head of a great office in London from which theological tracts came forth by hundreds. Obadiah Walker's press was not less active at Oxford, but with the exception of some bad translations of Bossuet's admirable works, these establishments put forth nothing of the smallest value. It was indeed impossible for any intelligent and candid Roman Catholic to deny that the champions of his church were, in every talent and acquirement, completely overmatched. The ablest of them would not, on the other side, have been considered as of the third rate. Many of them, even when they had something to say, knew not how to say it. They had been excluded by their religion from English schools and universities, nor had they ever, till the accession of James, found England an agreeable or even a safe residence. They had therefore passed the greater part of their lives on the continent, and had almost unlearned their mother tongue. When they preached, their outlandish accent moved the derision of the audience. They spelt like washerwomen. Their diction was disfigured by foreign idioms, and when they meant to be eloquent, they imitated, as well as they could, what was considered as fine writing in those Italian academies, where rhetoric had then reached the last stage of corruption. Disputants laboring under these disadvantages would scarcely, even with truth on their side, have been able to make head against men whose style is eminently distinguished by simple purity and grace. End Part 16.